This is episode 4-8 of Free as in Freedom.
Hi, I'm Karen Sandler.
And I'm Bradley Coon.
This is Free as in Freedom.
And we talked about how we owe it to these people who gave these talks that we broadcast them. And this was our co-organizer's talk. And he's never complained, actually, about the fact that we never had this talk.
Yeah, you would expect him to troll you about it.
Yeah, I think Fontana was not... I think he thinks his talks weren't as good as they were. This was actually a pretty good talk.
Yeah.
I mean, I've seen Fontana give not good talks. But most of them are pretty good, and this was a pretty good one.
I think he's a really good speaker. You know, I think about the time, I don't remember if we've ever talked about this before here, but I remember there was a talk we gave early in the days of SFLC, and it was one of the first talks I ever gave, and I was terrible. I was so bad. I remember, I can now superimpose myself back, I can see, be back in my, and see what I saw then, and look out onto the, you know, the audience listening to me, and I see people who I now know quite well, but who I only sort of vaguely knew who they were, people who are, you know, who really are, you know, freedom open source software luminaries in their own right, and, you know, and I am so embarrassed thinking about, like, seeing their bored expressions and remembering that I just wanted to cram all this nonprofits, so that's what I talked about, nonprofits, organizational stuff. And I wanted to cram that all in. And I must have given a terrible talk. And
yep. Yeah, I was required to be in the audience for that. And all the talks were pretty bad.
I mean, you know,
I have to admit.
In my defense, it wasn't like none of our talks were terrible. None of us were experienced speakers. So our style was bad. Because we were just not well practiced. And, you know, I mean, luckily, you know, I actually got a lot of great feedback from that talk, and there was a lot of good material that went online because of it. So phew, thank goodness. But you have to start somewhere. And,
you know,
when you know people, when they're in that stage, you sort of think of them as being that kind of speaker. And so the first time I ever saw Richard Fontana talk, it was at that same event, and he, like me, was not a very experienced speaker at the time, and he, like me, crammed in a lot of really boring stuff about patents. And you know, and when I compare that to his, you know, how he speaks now, which is, you know, I think he's a great speaker now. So it's funny to sort of, so it's like cool to sort of see how far people have come. So I think he's a good speaker.
Yeah, I agree with you that the first time I had to give a talk on the politics and policy of free software, I was very scared. I was, because I had to start giving technical talks very early on, because they teach you that when you're an undergrad. And I could give, I guess I thought there was such a big difference between, which I guess there kind of are differences between a purely technical content talk and something about a policy issue or something like that. So the first time I gave one, I wrote it all out just as text, and then I read it. And so I went way too fast. I'm already too fast of a speaker anyway. That's my worst problem with speaking. But because it was written out, I was just reading it, and it was really bad. And so, yeah, I gave some bad talks myself.
I mean, we all have to start somewhere, right?
Yeah, it's true. It was weird that the caterers could have spoken there, you know? The caterers were told not to speak, even though the caterers had lots of speaking experience. So, yeah, I didn't speak at that event, as Karen recalls, because I always said it would be like, me speaking would be like the caterers speaking. Is what the management said. So at that point, I had a lot of experience speaking about stuff. So it would have been nice. Dan Ravisher came up to me after. He's like, my talk was horrible, wasn't it? I said, yeah. Yeah.
I remember Dan speaking, and he wasn't terrible.
He was better than most of you, mainly because he had more experience, the same thing you were just saying.
Right. Evan gave a good talk, as I recall. It was very...
No, not really.
He's an orator.
It was actually
right
pretty Every bad. It was actually speaks, pretty bad like, talk by,
he riles
by
up
his standards.
But he's, you know, it doesn't, like, it almost doesn't matter what he says. He's like, he has that rhetoric, and it gets people
lots of flash, not much content.
I don't know. But anyway, whatever.
But Fontana's talk.
You know, every time I bring that up, I'm sorry I brought
it up. I don't know why you bring it up. You know what I'm going to say.
Well, because I was talking about something quite focused, and you, anyway.
I'm always going to say what I'm going to say about that particular event. Yeah, and the worst part is I was required to sit in the audience. That was I had to listen to all that. That was so painful.
To get back to the
But Fontana's talks have gotten so much better over the years, and
he's given a lot of them. And
you know, I have some issues with his topic for various reasons, which I'll talk about after we listen to his talk.
Our next speaker is Richard Fontana.
Don't clap until the end. So is everyone happy? Yeah. I didn't expect anyone to show up, but I guess some people did. So I have to explain, I always hate, as I say in many talks, I hate biography slides, but I have to explain this is my professional biography for the free software/open source part of my legal career, and it's relevant to this talk. So I've been my day job is at Red Hat. I've been at Red Hat for 5 years. I'm Red Hat's open source licensing counsel. Before 2008, I was at the Software Freedom Law Center for a few years. And I work primarily on the drafting of the GPLv3 license family with Richard Stallman and Evan Moglen. And this talk is sort of not really understandable on a personal level without knowing that biographical detail. Having said that, I want to make a very important disclaimer that this has nothing to do with my job at Red Hat whatsoever. It has nothing to do with the work I did in the past for the Free Software Foundation or SFLC, except in the sense that those experiences had, you know, kind of a personal impact on me, and continue to do so. And this is not, you know, this is not legal advice. I am a lawyer, but I'm not your lawyer. So this talk is about something called CopyleftNext. It's a license that I, a license drafting project that I started back in July of last year. So I would sum it up as an effort to transparently and collaboratively draft a new, simple, legally sound, GPL-like, and by that I mean strong copyleft, free software license. And secondarily, or maybe not so much secondarily, but another aspect of it is I see it as a vehicle for exploring new ideas for drafting free software licenses and for, you know, in the substantive sense, and also in the procedural sense, how the process for drafting things like free software licenses, how do we do that from a process perspective? I think it's a kind of experiment for looking at new ideas in that respect. I initially described it as a fork of GPLv3. I'm not sure whether I had I'm not sure whether I knew what I meant by that at the time, but this was sort of interpreted in different ways by different people, and it sounded kind of a more negative than I had intended. But at any rate, it really can't be called a fork of GPLv3 at this point, because it's the current license text is dramatically different from GPLv3. The interesting thing is that I started out with the text of GPLv3, so it started out as a fork and then turned into what is sort of a total rewrite that is somehow traceable back to the text of GPLv3. So it started in July 3rd of last year, and a formally numbered release came out a week ago, just in time for FOSDEM. So yes, we're using semantic versioning, so it's version 0.1.0. So just to explain what I mean by strong copyleft, because Bradley Kuhn, and there are no photos of Bradley Kuhn in this presentation, as people know. Karen is clapping. I've been criticized for that in the past. I think Bradley and I might disagree on what the definition of strong copyleft is, so I want to clarify what I mean by that. And other people may have a different understanding of what that is. So first of all, copyleft to me is a legal technique that is used in many free software licenses, pioneered in the GPL. And basically the idea, as I would express it, is that if you take software and you modify it or enhance it and you distribute it, First of all, if you're distributing in binary form, you have an obligation to provide some degree of source code that's modifiable by the users downstream. Second of all, there's a couple of legal requirements. One is that for at least the source code, and for some licenses, the binary and the source code, depending on how you interpret it, certainly for the GPL, ordinarily I would say it's the binary and the source code, they have to be distributed under the same license that you passed on upstream to them. There may be some alternative licenses, such as, you know, if you're distributing under GPL v2 or later, someone downstream is understood to have the permission to distribute under GPL v3 or later. But basically, you know, a similar license. There are some copyleft licenses that only impose these requirements for source code. And the GPL has this provision, this requirement to not impose further restrictions, which is part of the what I see as the copyleft requirement. So that's basically an attempt to define copyleft on the fly. When I say strong copyleft, all I mean is the FSF influence notion that the GPL applies in a scope sense, S-C-O-P-E, scope, to something bigger than licenses like the LGPL, which the FSF drafted after it had drafted earlier versions of the GPL, or licenses like the Mozilla Public License, which are in a sense a very minimalistic kind of copyleft license. So the MPL is more or less scoped according to the source file. The source file is kind of the unit of copyleft. But the GPL tries to do something much bigger. The GPL tries to make it very difficult to make proprietary enhancements of free software. That's really kind of the design goal of GPL. And so the GPL has to do that. The GPL has this understanding in it and in its interpretation, in its interpretive history, that the copyleft requirement applies to a fairly broad scope. And figuring out what that means is not necessarily easy. But I don't mean, when I say strong copyleft, I don't mean relative restrictiveness or non-restrictiveness of features other than this scope idea. So I'm talking about, you know, GPL versus LGPL. I'm not talking about this, you know, Bradley said, might have said yesterday in our panel about AGPL that, or at least you've said this in talks we've had together, that you consider AGPL E3 to be a stronger copyleft than the GPL. That is not the sense of GPL, of strong copyleft that I mean. Because in my view, GPL v3, GPL v2, and AGPL v3 have the same notion of copyleft scope built into them. Some people might disagree with that. There's also an assumption in this project that strong copyleft is something that you can legally implement, and that it's worthwhile to try to do so. So there are lawyers out there who believe that strong copyleft, you know, the GPL as commonly interpreted by its advocates is sort of legally impossible. There are a number of lawyers who say this. I think there are some developers who say this. This is not my view, and this is not the assumption of this project. The assumption of this project is that it makes sense and there's a way to implement it. Figuring out what that is one of the goals of the project. So there are certain goals of this effort that have developed over time. It wasn't entirely clear at the beginning that all of these would be goals, but basically brevity and conciseness, making it a simple license. You know, GPL v3 is a very complex license. I wanted to try to create something similar but very simple, something that developers and lawyers can understand, because I often heard criticism about GPL v3, often from developers, that it was hard for them to understand. I heard from lawyers that it was hard for them to understand. So that bothered me. Something that has a very clear structure. And this talk is a little hard to appreciate if you haven't actually looked at the text of these licenses, of the GPL, GPL v2, GPL v3, to get a sense of what I'm kind of getting at here, you know, the degrees of complexity. But making it a clear license, a consistent license, I would describe GPL v3 especially as a very Baroque license. Evan Moglen once described it that way, and I agree with that. I'm trying to draft something in this project that is very, very non-Baroque. Another goal is to make the legal implementation of the core copyleft features that you see in the GPL as legally airtight as possible. So I'm not saying there's a problem in the GPL, but I want to explore ways of just sort of like starting over and looking at the problem anew. Are there any ways that we could make this as legally sound as possible? There's this separate issue of proprietary licensing, which we were talking about yesterday in our panel on the AGPL. So proprietary licensing is Bradley Kuhn's term for what's often called dual licensing in the business model sense, a dual, usually copyleft and proprietary licensing. It's a business model that's been common in the open source era. And I think this is a very problematic business model, and it has had problematic consequences for the fate of copyleft and the GPL. And so I even before I ever thought of doing something like this, I thought, a future version of the GPL should probably try to do something about this problem, even if there's some signs that it's going away in a sense as a kind of business phenomenon, but it still exists. And this is a kind of challenge. I mean, I've had talks with Bradley. He has said that you can't solve this problem in a copyleft license. And so I saw it as a challenge that to try to figure out how to do so. I also, even though there's no photos of Bradley, this is also influenced by Bradley. So enforcement and compliance, I believe very strongly that the GPL is a kind of under-enforced license, and this is something that is clearly of great concern to many GPL licensors and developers who use the GPL. And so I think maybe there's ways we can make the license easier to enforce and easier to comply with if you're the licensee. And also, I've sort of said this, an idea, it could be a way for exploring new ideas for features of free software licenses more generally. And I also believe that these free software licenses are not—they're not anti-commercial, of course. So they should be commercially reasonable. That's a term that we lawyers, at least in the U.S., like to use, and it doesn't have any clear meaning. But basically, I sort of think that there's a way to write a GPL-like license that is commercially reasonable. And I'm not suggesting that the existing versions of the GPL are not commercially reasonable. I think they are, but I think that I don't want to deviate from that goal. So to explain where this comes out of. So, I mean, this is not a new idea to draft a non-GPL copyleft license. There have been lots of copyleft licenses drafted since GPL v2, which became the dominant copyleft license. The LGPL actually can be seen as one example of this, that the FSF was involved in drafting, although Cygnus may have been involved as well. We don't actually know the truth of that. But one thing that's different about this, so pretty much all the mainstream attempts, not counting like AGPL v1 and not counting the FSF's own successor versions of GPL, the mainstream attempts to write copyleft licenses since GPL v2 have been weak copyleft licenses, so even weaker than the LGPL. So, and again, by weak, I mean that issue of scope. So the MPL is a good example. The MPL was a very influential license, even though it was never widely adopted, because there were many kind of corporate vanity licenses that were modeled on it, and they all preserved that feature of the MPL that defined copyleft scope according to the source file. It was a very kind of minimalistic way of defining scope. So these are all weak copyleft licenses. I'm trying to draft a strong copyleft license. And the other thing is that these other attempts are. I don't know if this is that significant because of what I said about this not really being a fork, but these other attempts were attempts to write new copyleft licenses from scratch. The MPL is a pretty good example of this. Mitchell Baker wanted to write her own copyleft license from scratch. Some influences of the GPL, but I wanted to start with the GPL text for better or worse. The biggest influence on this project for me was something that Allison Randall wrote in 2007, just as GPL v3 was being wrapped up. She wrote a very strong critique of GPL v3 in its near final form called GPL v3 Clarity and Simplicity, where she argued that the FSF basically drafted a very confusingly complex license that developers would just not understand, and only you'd have to be a lawyer to understand the license. And this is a powerful critique of GPL v3. By that time, there was really no way to kind of incorporate that feedback, because the FSF very much wanted to wrap up GPLV3. It was actually already 6 months or so behind its schedule. But this had a big effect on my thinking, and it continued to do so for many years. A little less influential, but something I remember from that time as well was a professor from the University of Washington Law School and a former Microsoft in-house counsel, Bob Gamowicz, wanted to try to write an open source license that, in his view, would do the things that the GPL does, GPLv2 does, but in very simple language. And this may have come out of his experiences at Microsoft, because actually Microsoft, if you've looked at Microsoft consumer, shrink wrap software licenses, they're actually, the recent ones are very simple and easy to read. So this license, the simple public license, is in that spirit. It's a very, very simple copyleft license. I don't think he succeeded in writing a GPL-like license. I don't interpret it as doing what the GPL tries to do. But nonetheless, the spirit is somewhat similar to what I ended up wanting to do. So this also more immediately descends from my talk a year ago at FOSDEM, where I talked about this meme that the GPL is in decline. In the concluding part of this talk, I suggested that there might be some decline in use of the GPL, popularity of the GPL among developers, and that the complexity, particularly of GPLv3, but of GPL generally, might be one reason for this. And increasingly, what I saw is a vacuum of community license interpretation. So what I mean by that is that historically, Richard Stallman especially and the FSF generally played a very active role in license interpretation, and I believe it retreated from that over the past several years. And I believe that created this kind of interpretive vacuum that made it harder for developers and users to kind of understand how to apply the terms of the license to particular fact situations. It's speculation. It's consistent with some things I've heard anecdotally, but it's just, I can't say that there's like hard evidence of this. But this is something that I thought might be the case, and that it might be contributing to a competitive disadvantage for the GPL, an unnecessary one, because there's no reason why the GPL has to be complex, in my view. It has to be more complex than the simplest licenses, for sure. But I'm not sure why GPLv3, for example, has to be twice as long as GPLv2, for example. I also argued in this talk that there was this, as a result of this complexity, there's this atmosphere, this undesirable atmosphere of what I called inscrutability and hyper-legalism that surrounded the GPL, which really started to bother me. Actually, this Alison Randall was getting at this in her 2007 essay, so I think I was influenced by the things she had said. She also talked about the potential for disempowering developers. I don't know if she exactly put it that way, but I began to see that as well, that perhaps developers were feeling disempowered by a license that was kind of too big for them to easily understand. And maybe developers all along, or maybe developers, the newer generation of developers, preferred for licenses to be relatively simple and minimalistic. So I said in this talk that maybe we should start thinking about what GPLv4 should look like, and that maybe it could, maybe it would be a license that the FSF wouldn't draft, because I didn't anticipate that the FSF would draft a new version of the GPL anytime soon. And I said in this talk that it could be as short as the Apache license 2.0, which today is a pretty popular license in some communities. So a basic assumption I made is that these licenses are not perfect, and I sometimes think that there are some people who think they are perfect for some reason. I don't quite understand why. All of these commonly used, not to mention the uncommonly used, free software licenses are very imperfect. They all have flaws, and this is unavoidable because they're the product of human invention. And so that means they can be improved. And I don't think that the improvement should be monopolized by particular privileged entities. I feel that very strongly. That's a basic assumption here, that we don't have to wait for the FSF to take another 15 years to write GPLv4. We can start thinking about what a similar license might look like now. Another assumption is that, there is this view that maybe some of this doesn't really matter because developers tend not to read the licenses they use, and there's probably something to that, unfortunately. But I actually do believe that enough developers do read the licenses they use or think about using or encounter in the software they use enough developers do that I think that, that this does, these issues do matter. So if it were the case that developers just don't read any licenses that they use, that would be highly problematic, but it also would make this effort kind of less relevant. Two things that really sparked my starting this project. That's Brett Smith. Brett Smith was the license compliance engineer at the FSF and someone who I got to know when I was at SFLC, and I continued to have contact with him when I was at Red Hat. And I really saw him as kind of the legal genius at the FSF, and someone who had a lot of knowledge and good ideas about GPL interpretation. It was kind of keeping that historical continuum of interpretation alive. And then he left, and I saw, maybe unfairly, I was very worried about this. And I thought, and I felt kind of despair about this, that the FSF had lost its greatest legal authority, right? I mean, and Richard Stallman, you could say, is the greatest authority, but he, Richard Stallman, I think, had withdrawn from an active role in license interpretation. And Brett Smith was someone who took on a role like that, but he left. And the other thing, this is a reference to Bradley. So Bradley, in a broadcast of a longer version of the talk I gave at FOSM last year, Bradley, in some commentary, accused me of being a mere gadfly.
I didn't say mere gadfly.
But you meant you meant mere gadfly. You said he's just a gadfly because he talks about how the GPL is too complex, but I don't see him drafting any licenses.
Did I say that?
You did
something
say that.
Like
oh my God.
This is one possible gadfly, the deer botfly. So that's what Bradley thinks of. It's more on the, you know, why am I actually doing this? I'm tempted to say why not, but I know that's not satisfactory. So if there is this, you know, building on my talk from last year, if strong copyleft is in disfavor, maybe we need a brand new effort. Maybe we need to just kind of start over. Maybe there's too much historical baggage associated with the FSF, associated with Stallman and Eben Moglen and the existing, you know, versions of the GPL. Maybe there's all this historical baggage that is burdening the GPL somehow, and we have to kind of you know, start over, and that might give us an advantage. I have this view that there is this optimal balance between copyleft and non-copyleft. And if this is out of balance, maybe we need an effort to correct that. And so that's sort of my idea. The other thing is, you know, even if no one uses copyleft next as a license, it might still influence the next generation of licenses that people do draft and use, right? And there's the process side too, which I'll get into, that it'll influence expectations for how you draft licenses. And there's an element of fun, at least I felt that at some times. Right? And very personal things that, for me, I worked on GPLv3 as the primary part of my job for a year and a half, and it still feels like it was never finished to me. I thought that the FSF should have gone on and continue to improve it. Maybe especially after that essay by Allison Randall in May. I remember saying this to Eben, you know, maybe we should take another 6 months and keep working on this. And of course the FSF didn't want to do this. But for me, it will just always feel like a living thing that is unfinished. And that's just a very personal thing. So if you haven't looked at it, and if you haven't looked at GPLv3, GPLv2, you want to be able to appreciate this, but so I want to give you some sense of how it's different in style. It's basically very short and tries to be copyleft next. It tries to be very, very simple and easy to understand. At least that's the goal. One example is word counts, which I talked about in my talk last year. If you do word counts of these are various licenses, you know, GPL family plus I decided to use MPL 2.0 just because it's an interesting relatively recent. License that's been drafted, and the Apache license is kind of interesting because it's popular as a non-copyleft license. Copyleft next 0.1.0 is shorter than all of these other licenses, much shorter than GPLv3. So line counts, by that I mean if you look at the canonical text version of the license, this is kind of a sense of like how visually complex it looks if you try to read the text form of the license. You know, maybe a questionable measure. But again, you see that it's kind of copyleft next is sort of, you know, shorter than the Apache license in a line length sense, and much shorter than GPLv3. And, you know, maybe the most questionable measure, but I think still valuable, is license section size. So what I did was I took the average section of line length of numbered sections of license, and this is what you get. So what this shows is, at least, is that copyleft next, as currently drafted, has very short, easily digestible sections, where something like GPLv3 has, it's characterized by relatively long sections. I mean, there's some that are longer than others. But I think, you know, the assumption is that the longer a section is, the harder it is to digest. The MPL is sort of an unfair measure for MPL 2.0 because that has a lot of numbered subsections. So maybe that's unfair.
And the short lines.
Did you try counting GPL without all the four examples as such and so forth?
No, I did not.
Yeah.
So, substantively, I do think it is interesting that I drafted this not from scratch, but by starting out with the GPL v3 text. And I sort of, it's understandable why I would want to do that. But I suppose I could have started from scratch and would have ended up with something maybe similar. But what I did was I just kept cutting things out, because my goal was I wanted to get down to the length of the Apache license. So I went through the text of the GPL, GPL v3, and looked for things that could be cut out. So, and everything I looked at, I would apply this test, is the incremental complexity associated with the addition of this sentence or this paragraph worth it? Is it worth it making the license more complex, having this in, or do we gain more by taking it out? And you know, one of the features of this license, copyleft next, is that it's outbound GPL compatible. So I saw that as kind of a safety measure, that it gave room to experiment. Because if you care a lot about, for example, Bradley cares about the what he would call anti-tibialization, well, maybe he wouldn't. Anti-lockdown provisions of GPLv3. Those are taken out of copyleft next, but that's okay because it's GPLv3 compatible. So you can use copyleft next code in GPLv3 works, and they'll be covered by the GPLv3 copyleft under many circumstances. I also think that being able to rely on the background history of the GPL allows a license to be simpler. So I think GPLv3 made a mistake in this respect, because it may have tried too much to codify that interpretive history. It wasn't really necessary to codify it, because GPLv2 has gotten by pretty well without that, obviously, without that codification, because it was a post-GPLv2 interpretive history. Like, all, you know, an example is easily understandable, is all the interpretation that the FSF puts in its FAQ about the GPL. I mean, that's part of the interpretive history of the GPL. And it works. It helps us understand what GPLv2 means. It's not perfect, but you know, we can rely on that. If copyleft next is a successor to the GPL, it can rely on this interpretive history. Just some things that I deleted. So there's lots of stuff. You know, there's superfluous phrases. There's things that are sort of obviously true in the GPLv3 text. There's just totally aspirational statements in GPLv3 that we don't need. There are clauses in GPLv3 that I don't remember the rationale for them, and I'm certain that Richard Stallman and Evan Moglen don't remember the rationale for them. So if we don't remember what they're there for, we don't need them. There are provisions that don't have any counterpart in GPLv2 or other free software open source licenses. And that itself is not reason enough not to have them, but it's a reason to raise questions about them. If no other license needs a particular provision, why is GPLv3 needed, right? So why should copyleft next need it? There are some that seem to have served basically no purpose since 2007. There's some provisions that really could be offloaded to an FAQ. That's actually something, in a way, how GPLv3 was drafted. It took things that were in the FSF's FAQ and put them in the license. And I won't go through, you know, these are just some examples. If you're familiar with the GPLv3 text, you might know what some of these things are. You actually probably wouldn't know them, because some of them are my own nicknames for these provisions.
Why do you blame James for the exceptions clause?
I don't blame James. James Fazil suggested deleting the exceptions clause, because early on in this project, James Fazil was active when it was on GitHub. And one of the things he filed a GitHub issue saying, we don't need an acceptance clause. And he's right. If the FSF has insisted for years that the GPL is a license but not a contract, acceptance is a contract law concept. So if we really believe these are not contractual things, and I'm not going to take a position on that, why on earth do you need an acceptance clause? It takes up, you know, three or four lines. So you can save space. Oh, I have to mention the BitTorrent distribution clause, because Bradley used to talk about that a lot. It's a totally ridiculous clause, in my opinion, because GPLv2 gets by without it. And Bradley, you know, I remember you said that you violate GPLv2 if you use BitTorrent for distribution ordinarily. And that's absurd, because no one would ever enforce in that situation, right? It's in some ways, the BitTorrent distribution clause in GPLv3 is an example for me, an emblematic example of everything that is suboptimal about GPLv3. We don't need a BitTorrent distribution clause. No other free software license, including GPLv2, has that clause, and you know things work fine. Section 7, additional permissions. I used to love this section of GPLv3 because I drafted so much of it and thought so much about it. But it's really not necessary. Additional permissions are things that you can obviously impose on a program for which you have copyright permission. The additional requirements are things that come out of the interpretive tradition, which can be encapsulated in an FAQ. They don't have to be codified into a license. So it's just not necessary. Some things that are more interesting than others that I deleted to, you know, to get down to that goal of getting to the size of the Apache license. So this anti-circumvention clause, which was one of the innovative features of GPLv3, this targets a provision of the DMCA and a corresponding provision of EU law, and it's a clause that, you know, I understand the political reason for it. The GPLv3 was drafted in a background of concern about DRM and the use of law to extend copyright and so forth. But if you actually look at this provision, it doesn't really do very much. It's a very narrow provision. It's probably never been invoked. It's a circumstance triggering its use. It's probably never arisen. So it serves no real purpose. And so it can be deleted. And I developed a view that if something just has a purely political value, it's not worth keeping in the license. It just makes things more complex. Probably very controversially, all the patent-related things that were added to GPLv3, with the exception of the express patent license grant, which is in copyleft next, I have deleted. All those Microsoft Novell provisions are gone. There's a very complex provision that I call, what's my nickname for it? The son of downstream shielding clause. This is gone. This is such a narrow, narrow provision. It's almost essentially a no-op, and it takes up about 10 lines. It's completely unnecessary. Bradley was upset about this. I took out the anti-tivoization provisions, or anti-lockdown provisions, because it's tempting to do so because they take up so much space. They're half of the longest provision of the license. And my view is, look, if you really care about this, so what influenced me was that, I found that developers who liked GPLv3, as many, I know many developers who do, most of them didn't really care about these provisions in my experience. I'm sure some do, right? But I found that most developers who were actually read GPLv3 and were attracted to it, they cared more about those patent provisions, which admittedly I mostly deleted. But I found that this was more of a concern for the FSF from a policy perspective than for even developers who ended up adopting GPLv3. Obviously, a concern for some. But if you really care about them, you can use GPLv3. So GPLv3 may be a good license if this is the most important thing for you. If you're familiar with the liberty or death clauses, this is one of the most famous provisions of GPLv2. It's GPLv2 section 7, GPLv3 section 12. The version in GPLv3 is actually narrower in a sense than the version in GPLv2. Even if you don't believe that, it is interesting that I have preserved it in a sense, but I turned it into one sentence. So just a very famous provision that's become one sentence. So more substantive stuff. I believe that there is a very simple, deep structure to the GPL behind the text, and I wanted to try to expose this. So the way I see, when you get, say, a copy of the Linux kernel from Linus Torvalds, this is applicable to a project that has multiple copyright holders, multiple licensors. What's actually going on is that you're getting multiple GPLs. This is not obvious, and people don't really think of it this way, but I think it's important to kind of try to think of it this way. You're getting multiple GPLs from all the upstream licensors. You only see one copy of the text because it's a uniform text, but you're getting multiple GPLs, and you're only getting one immediate GPL from Linus Torvalds. And the people who just distribute without any modification are licensees who are passing through the upstream licenses. So there's a provision in GPLv2 and GPLv3 called the automatic licensing clause that kind of expresses this concept. So this is in GPLv2 and GPLv3. You can get to this understanding, but it's not simply stated in a way that it could be. So copyleft next starts out, you know, without even any definitions, because I decided to put the definitions at the bottom, saying, you know, doing what a number of other licenses do, Creative Commons licenses, the Apache license, a number of other free licenses, do this kind of more conventional approach to writing license. You start out saying, you know, I use the term we for the licensor, what we are giving you. We are giving you a copyright license on the work that we provide. We are giving you a patent license on the work that we provide. Much simpler than the way things are expressed in GPLv2 and GPLv3. In GPLv2, there's no express patent license, but much simpler than GPLv3. But not altering the policy. The patent license is intended to have identical scope to the GPLv3 patent license, but it is much, much easier to understand, and I think presented in a way that is less likely to lead to the kind of FUD around GPLv3 that I have encountered in my day job from time to time. So the scope is not any narrower, but it's just by rewording and restructuring things, it looks a lot different, and it looks commercially reasonable. It looks like what you might find in a standards agreement, right? What was I saying there? So how do you implement strong copyleft? So I don't deviate very strongly from the basic approach of GPLv2 and GPLv3. It's done by wording and definitions. GPLv3 is a big improvement over GPLv2. So I have a new defined term called derived work. And so this Till Yeager yesterday gave a talk on what a derivative work means, at least under European law. And I think actually this term derivative work is used in GPLv2 and has dominated lawyer discourse about interpreting GPLv2 copyright, copyleft rather. But actually it's not, in my opinion, a correct reading of GPLv2. And GPLv3 intentionally got rid of such terminology because lawyers pointed out it was confusing. Richard Stallman didn't mean, in my opinion, he didn't mean to identify copyleft scope with the scope of derivative works under U.S. copyright law. He meant something a little broader than that. And if you read GPLv2 section 2 closely enough, you will see this, that what he was, I think, trying to do was get this at this notion of containers. So he wanted to try to make sure that it was hard to proprietize enhancements to a free program. So to do that, you know, he would use language of there's language of containership in GPLv2 section 2 that tries to get at this concept, and GPLv3 tried to improve on this. But I think this is, you know, I've tried to improve on this further with this defined term. I introduced a new term, defined term called separate work, which actually is based partly on this otherwise very complex definition of aggregate in GPLv3, and then partially to get at the system library exception in the GPL. There's this mere aggregation clause in GPLv2 and GPLv3, and it's much more complex in GPLv3, unnecessarily so. But I define mere aggregation as simply an aggregation of a derived work and a separate work. So suddenly it becomes very simple to kind of, at least at the level of definition, to say what the copyleft scope is, that it's limited by this concept of mere aggregation. And that's implicit in the GPL, in GPLv2, but it's never stated as clearly as it could be. So what about the goal of increasing the ability to enforce and to make compliance easier? There is a severability clause added, so that's a clause that basically says that if any, it's a standard clause in, you find in contracts and also legislation that says that if any portion of the license or whatever the instrument is unenforceable, you reform it to the extent necessary to make it enforceable. There's protection. There's just by some wording changes, I think there's stronger protection against upstream license revocation. There's a, you know, the obligations to what you have to do when you distribute software under Copyleft Next is simplified and rationalized relative to the GPL. So you don't have an affirmative obligation to put in copyright notices, for example, which no one does. Instead, you have an obligation to preserve notices. The object code distribution requirements, which are the most important thing from an enforcement perspective, are simplified. Instead of the 3-year written offer option, so 3-year written offer option is eliminated as something that is sort of outdated and kind of, you know, sort of not really necessary. You can point to a URL where source is available. The objection, I guess, is that some people won't have network access, but that just is not realistic enough in most cases to justify a much more complex provision. So corresponding source definition is really in some ways the most important one. It moves back to the GPLv2 approach because I think it's clearer, but in discussions with Bradley, I didn't accept all of Bradley. Bradley submitted some patches to this part, which I mostly rejected. But
wholly rejected.
No, because you added this requirement to provide a list of separate works, which you were talking about, I think, yesterday in the compliance panel, and this idea that you should provide information on the build environment. And I think that's something that neither version of the GPL does today, but is a good idea. So this is an advance over earlier versions of the GPL. So another thing is this notion of copyleft misuse, which is partly the proprietary relicensing problem. That's Martin Mikos and Larry Augustine, by the way. So I talked about proprietary relicensing. I blame proprietary relicensing partly for any possible decline in use of the GPL, because I think it tarnished the reputation of the GPL. And I really wanted to kind of meet that challenge of seeing if a copyright license could do something about this problem. So all previous licenses, you know, copyleft licenses have ignored this problem. So the solution is actually very simple, although it's really hard to draft. So the solution is, basically, if we do proprietary relicensing, the copyleft goes away and you have a BSD-style license. It's not a totally original idea because it was influenced by the old treaty with Trolltech that KDE made, where Qt would be placed under a BSD license if Trolltech failed to release a free version of Qt. But it goes a step further, and it's intended to discourage. It's not meant to be like an airtight requirement. Rather, it's intended to keep that, you know, that sort of anyone inclined towards that sort of business model away from this license. So to keep this license pure. Very difficult to draft. I'm very dissatisfied with its current drafting, and stylistically, it's very GPLv3-ish. The other misuse is provision is the anti-badge work provision. So very unfortunately, GPLv3, towards the end of its drafting phase, added this authorization to impose a limited form of what was known at the time as badgeware requirements. These are requirements to put in these powered by logos on modified versions of software, really designed cynically, you know, to kind of discourage modification by, you know, commercial users. And this was a terrible addition to GPLv3. This is precluded in Copyleft Next, because the provision that says you have to preserve legal notices makes clear that logos or other graphical images are not author attribution. So it does say that you have to preserve author attributions, but logos are not author attributions. Actually, some discussions with Pam had a big influence on me with respect to these provisions. So the approach to upgradability, if you're familiar with the GPL, you know what the GPL does. It's if you specify just one version, you have permission to use any other version, like Linux kernel. If no version is designated, you can use any version. And many GPLv2 programs are licensed as GPLv2 or any later version. That's understood to mean that you can sort of distribute downstream under GPLv3 or a later version. Most other copyleft licenses have a built-in or later provision, and you know, it's a difficult policy question. You know, what you should do, which one is better? And I think that the FSF, it's interesting that the FSF has been criticized for promoting the use of or later when these other copyleft licenses have not been criticized for having a built-in provision. So the compromise, which was suggested by Mike Linsfair, is that the default is that you have permission to use later versions unless the licensor explicitly says you can't. So that's kind of the Linux kernel approach. License compatibility, basically it's not necessary to have that section 7 in GPL3, as I was saying, because you know, the GPL2 policy is kind of preserved because we still have this prohibition on imposition of additional restrictions. And you have explicit compatibility for the Apache license, which is considered not compatible with GPLv2. And it's outbound compatible with any version of the GPL or AGPLv3 or later. So it's, you know, there's really no difference in license compatibility. If anything, it's much more compatible than any version of the GPL or AGPL. Termination policy, you know, GPLv2 has this harsh automatic termination. GPLv3 has this very complex alternative approach, way too complex than is necessary. Copyleft Next just says, you know, it's you have a 30-day cure period and on notice of violation, and if you cure within 30 days, you get your license back. There's a patent peace provision, patent retaliation provision, that is kind of like what's in the MPL 2.0. There's something like this in GPLv3, but it's sort of hidden away, so it's much more explicit by putting it in the termination provision. Just talking about the process now. So to understand the legacy here, most free software licenses were not drafted transparently. So before GPLv3, basically you drafted these in private, maybe with a lawyer, if you had a lawyer, and then you might circulate a draft publicly on a mailing list or Usenet or something, you know, a month before promulgating the final version. GPLv3 changed that, had a much more public process, but it wasn't purely public. And there were some problematic things about the GPLv3 process. It resembled, in some ways, the worst aspects of the legislative and regulatory process, at least what we see in the United States. There was basically, you know, a lot of private lobbying for particular provisions, because funnily enough, many companies thought that this GPLv3 was really going to replace GPLv2, and so they had a stake in trying to lobby the FSF for what should be in the license or not. And this bothered me a lot. And another experience that wasn't about free software license drafting, but was an important effort in the area of legal document drafting, was Project Harmony, which was an attempt to write uniform contributor agreements. This was an effort that had a Chatham House rule, confidential mailing list. It was like sort of like GPLv3 in many respects. It was dominated by these kind of lawyer interest groups. So Copyleft Next does something that is kind of unprecedented, I think, which is to adopt the methodology that free software projects use. So and my idea, maybe naive, was I thought this could encourage developers to get involved. So there's a public Git repository. Git is the technique for modifying the license. There's a public mailing list, an IRC channel. I am the self-appointed beneficial dictator, not necessarily for life. Most of it is written by me. I hope that isn't always the case. There is a small community of participants. I'm very ambivalent towards increasing lawyer involvement, basically because of my experiences in these other efforts, right? And also for, you know, I don't know, I'm kind of ambivalent about this, promoting this effort, right? So there's this thing we call the Harvey Birdman rule, and that's just the name is just a private joke, but it's actually kind of significant. The two goals of the Harvey Birdman rule, actually I think Bradley suggested the name. Maximize transparency in license drafting and to avoid undue influence of non-developer interest groups, with basically lawyers, right? So the most important provision is that, you know, basically you're expected to talk about the license proposals for substantive changes to the license in public. So you shouldn't use private back channels. But if you do use private back channels, you have an obligation to cure that violation of the rule by providing a summary of what you talked about privately to a public forum. And in fact, Bradley and I have done this on a number of occasions.
I owe one, actually. Sorry about that. Yeah. What's the cure period for that?
There's no time period, but you should cure period. So just like a few other like parts of this Harvey Birdman rule, you can see how this is designed to kind of keep lawyers at bay. So if you let lawyers control a license drafting process, what technologically will happen is they will pass around redline Microsoft Word documents. And I don't want that to be the way this kind of license is drafted. So I think that lawyers should get involved, but they have to meet the developer culture, because this is supposed to be a license for developers. So no word processing documents, no Chatham House rule, nothing like Project Harmony, no top posting. So actually, to my surprise, this is designed to discourage lawyer involvement, in a sense, or to kind of constrain lawyer involvement. But Josh Gay, who's the replacement for Brett Smith at the FSF, tends to top post, so he's been kind of given a warning about this. So I want to, while I still have some time, I want to talk about objections. So people have said, this is illegitimate because it will increase license proliferation, and we don't need any new licenses. So the license proliferation argument, this is something we hear all the time. I think it's an overblown problem. There is license diversity in free software licensing, and I think we've gotten, I can see in the commercial world that people have gotten used to this. It's just expected, right? And it's a problem that's getting smaller over time because projects are using, more standard, de facto standard licenses. So it's a disappearing problem if it even is a problem. There's not a problem of commons fragmentation, if that's what the concern about license proliferation is, because Copyleft Next is, it's GPL compatible in both directions, right? So there's no fragmentation of the commons. And that's kind of related to this idea that I see Copyleft Next as a possible gradual replacement to GPLv2, GPLv3. And if the concern about proliferation is that it's going to be hard to understand lots of licenses, this is a license that places a premium on comprehensibility. And then what about this idea that we shouldn't have any new licenses, that it's somehow wrong to draft a new license? This is idea that you can't possibly improve GPLv3, and I just don't know how to respond to this because it's absurd. These licenses are not perfect. None of them are perfect. GPL is worse than others. The Apache license could certainly be improved. The Eclipse public license could seriously be improved. But these are not perfect licenses. But the more disturbing part of this is what I see as a barriers to entry issue, that only a privileged set of license stewards are the ones who can draft new licenses. So yesterday, Jerv gave a talk where he talked about helping out with MPL 2.0, but then he said he had some comment about people who draft their own licenses. And it occurred to me, why is it okay for Mitchell Baker to draft a license, but not any other person? So I'm very disturbed by this kind of elitism that has developed in the free software and open source world, that there are the legal elitism, that there are these powerful but established institutions that control future license drafting. So we can accept, Apache license 3.0, but no one outside the system necessarily has a chance of, having their license become accepted in this sense.
Can I defend myself from a charge of promoting elitism?
Yes.
I merely said that, I merely joked that it was great if everybody wrote their own license, like that it wasn't. I didn't say that only people who've currently written licenses should write licenses, but I do think that there are a lot of people who attempt to draft a license do a very bad job.
Yes, that's true, but don't think that the licenses that are widely used are so perfect, because they're not. They have lots of flaws, and the reason we don't think about that is because they're widely used. So these are just some possible future changes. I want to have some kind of a Pharaoh version of Copyleft Next. I anticipate rapid versioning. I don't know if that's going to happen or not. More license compatibility. And maybe Copyleft Next could actually become the basis for something I always used to fear, which is a kind of Creative Commons style suite of licenses embracing different policy points of view in free software licenses. So there could be a non-Copyleft variant of Copyleft Next. It was the proprietary relicensing poison pill that made me realize this. So that's a possibility. So this is information, I'll make these slides public. This is how you can get to participate. And the hyena is the proposed mascot for Copyleft Next. I'm offended by that, just let me know. And that's it. Chris.
Oh, okay. So I'm actually curious about what you're suggesting of basically these kind of variants that are almost either extensions of restrictions or extensions by waiving things. Now, how do you intend to go about that in what's the scope on that?
Are you talking about the sort of Creative Commons style?
Right. And I'm also curious, if you end up creating permissive dashbacks, will it actually just be one big extension that just waves?
No, what I anticipate is that you cut out sections. This is not an original idea. So Larry Rosen did this with the AFL and the OSL, which are not widely used licenses that he drafted. One is a permissive license, one's a copyleft license. They're basically identical except for one section. So that's what I kind of see, that you might have optional sections. And so this is kind of what Creative Commons does, because it has a lot of uniform language in its licenses. I have a lot of criticisms of Creative Commons licenses, but I think there's something that we could possibly learn from their approach. Yes, Stefano.
I wonder whether you mentioned two reasons basically for this perceived decline of copyleft. One is habits of young developers, new generations, and the other one is complexity. I wonder whether you have been considering other options, other reasons.
Yeah. If you can hear a recording of my talk at the Linux Foundation Collab Summit, where I talk all about this. So the complexity argument is just one piece of it. It's,
thank you. I think I support a lot of your ideas and observations, so I think that's a very good project.
Patch is welcome, but no Microsoft Word documents.
Yeah, you wanted to extract lawyers, but that will not work. I have one question to you as a US lawyer. So my observation on GPL3 is that there are many good ideas, but it's a little bit, the drafting is like German tax law. You see a lot of very specific rules that are correct and they have a background, and GPL2 is more generalistic, and I think that's your approach. So under German law, that's very easy because you have an interpretation. If you find the idea of the license and you have problems that are not in the license, you can find solutions by interpretation.
Yeah, so
under US law the same? I think, for example, the ASP loophole, the US lawyers say there's a loophole in the GPL2 and have problems with that. And the German law, I think we do not have any problems with that. We can say, okay, this is from 91, we have a new situation, what is the idea of the license? Yes, we can close that loophole with this license without any new clauses. Is this possible under U.S. law?
I believe it is, and I say that because I think that this is kind of the situation we have with GPLv2. And, the FSF's interpretation has been very influential. Is it possible in a formal legal sense under U.S. law? I don't know. I think so. It should be. It's problematic because, of course, you have licensors with different interpretations, and I anticipate that this project will eventually have FAQs that will get into like the kinds of details that I don't want to be in the license text itself, because it will make it too complex. Rather.
So you didn't say this explicitly, but you have said on the mailing list that you want to treat license drafting like a free software project, and there are of course lots of different types. Is that correct or no?
Sort of, yeah.
But the problem I'm finding, and maybe this could be my fault because you unilaterally tried to make me the co-maintainer and I declined.
You had your chance.
So I missed my chance in some sense. But I noticed that I've submitted a lot of patches that have been rejected in a Linus Torvalds style of just, you don't know what you're doing. And none of my patches are in. If you look at the current version of the text, you wrote all of it. You look at the Git plane, it's all you. So my point is that I don't feel like you're running it like a dictatorship, and I don't think that's the best government. Now, that's a valid.
Okay, so let's move it to the Apache Foundation. I will talk to Jim Jagielski. I am all for this. All right. We just have to put the text under the Apache license.
Well, you've seen text to mine on the plane home, so yeah. You're going to take my patches before we land.
any other questions? Yes, Mark.
Commit messages seem better than most developers' commit messages. Are you trying to...
This is because Bradley criticized me for having very brief commit messages, and I thought, oh, okay, you're supposed to have long commit messages? I didn't realize that.
No, but are you trying to build up this body of thinking about the GPFv3 that people can use later when they're new
person? I think it could... So one thing that bothers me about GPL3 is that the FSF has not yet published a lot of the documents that were supposed to be made public that surrounded the drafting process. And so I guess part of what has motivated me with some of those, commit messages, I know that you've tried to do that. Maybe it's a resources issue.
I can say something when you got it.
But that's partly, I want that story to be told to the extent that it can be told. And that's the reason for some of the commit messages being kind of elaborate. But it's mainly that I thought, oh, you're supposed to have like lengthy commit messages. I didn't realize that. And that, then I realized later on that many developers don't do that. So I was mistaken or someone misled me. So
it's not that it's not a good idea. You're just lazy.
Yeah, I share that laziness. So.
What's the story, John?
So it's literally on the brink of being done.
Oh, good. Okay.
Down before he left, but couldn't quite finish. The issue was that people, each committee in the process, had different rules about what exactly they wanted to make public from their internal discussions, and some of them did not do such a good job in removing personal information from the exchanges. So we've had to scrub phone numbers.
I hear. Yeah, that's true.
So it's a logistical resource problem, but it's definitely been a goal and it will happen.
Yes.
Have you talked about excluding military use as a default option? Because I think every new license should.
This is going to be a free software license. This is a free software license,
yep.
And free software licenses allow military use.
So as most people know, I gave Fontana a pretty hard time. He initially named that project GPL Next.
Right.
Which the FSF was obviously not happy with. And Fontana agreed to change the name.
I was surprised that he didn't work with the FSF to begin with, though, to be honest.
Well, he's Fontana.
What does that mean?
Fontana likes to be a cowboy.
Can you elaborate?
Well, he likes to be out in the out in the Wild West doing things, you know, not tied to any particular authority. That's his style.
Well, okay.
So.
It's funny to think of a lawyer being like that.
Yeah, he's actually literally said before, which is kind of a joke because of McCain, that he's a maverick. It's a fun time. It's like, I'm a maverick. He said that.
That's funny.
He said it in IRC many times. But it's kind of a silly joke because of McCain using it. When McCain
well, it's funny because I think of him as being a very very thoughtful licensing lawyer.
Well, yes. So it's funny because this is a year and a half ago, and so my notes from a year and a half ago on this talk, I noted that I was still upset of him about the removing the lockdown provisions from Copyleft Next, but now he's talking about putting them back in lately. So,
oh really?
Yeah, and the Affero clause too, for that matter.
So has it been active since then? I haven't been following.
He did a couple of changes recently.
Is there engagement or
no?
Is it
I think
that he has.
I think Fontana said this. I don't know if he said. This is where we haven't listened to the talk in a long time. But he's pointed out multiple times. This is a personal project of his that he's doing as a volunteer, leisurely kind of project. That's his own thing. I think he was legitimately surprised that. I mean, this was part of the GPL Next changing to the name Copyleft Next issue. That he was. I think he was legitimately surprised that it got press coverage when he launched it.
I wonder why that is. I mean, he's one of the key authors of GPLv3.
We had an argument. Fontana and I had an argument on a mailing list about this. RMS says that he is the author of GPLv3, GPLv2, and GPLv3, publicly in his talks. So.
Oh, really?
Yes.
He's the author? But
I wrote. RMS says in his talk, I wrote the GPL, both v3 and v2. In the context, he was actually talking about v3.
But he clearly wrote it with help.
Yeah, but I wasn't in the room, so I don't know, but that's what RMS says publicly. He says he wrote the GPL. So, and I know what Fontana says about sections that he wrote. I always think of Fontana as the primary author of LGPL V3, because I think he was.
He was definitely, I don't remember what I said exactly, but I thought I said key authors, and I think I wouldn't necessarily.
RMS claims he is the author, the sole author. Fontana had a back and forth on GPL violations.
But it obviously isn't true that he's the only author.
That's what he says. I don't know. How do we know? We weren't in the room.
But you just referred to provisions that Fontana wrote.
Fontana claims he wrote, yes. That's true. And I was talking about the LGPL, which I know that Fontana wrote large parts of that. Mm-hmm. And RMS says that as well. That Fontana did write large parts of LGPL. I don't know. This is what RMS says. I was busy, as we said in this thread. I'll link to this thread in the show notes. We had a thread on GPL violations about somebody started asking who wrote the GPL, and so those of us who had knowledge about it started having this thread about. And I posted
and so
that RMS
says
that.
Fontana say about this.
He says his usual thing that some sections were written by various companies. He says that there are sections that he wrote. We had this long discussion of RMS as the final editor and how much was his editing, how much was his writing. I basically ended up saying, well, I only know based on what you guys say because there's...
Do you think RMS would say that he was the author of the GCC Runtime Library?
No, I don't think so.
No?
Yeah. No, I don't think so. Because I actually wrote most of that. And you and Brett were the other two co-authors. So I don't think RMS would take credit for that.
Well, I mean, he wrote some of it.
He made some suggestions.
He marshaled the process.
Who, RMS?
RMS. I remember being in meetings with him where he, you know...
The meetings we had with RMS about the GCC, this is off topic from Copyleft Next and Fontana's talk, but the meetings we had with RMS, I recall being us trying to basically convince RMS of various solutions.
Right, we had to convince him.
Right, he had to agree to the license. That's definitely true.
Anyway, I don't want to reveal too much. I was in that context. I was a lawyer, acting on on behalf of a client. So
yeah, I mean, now that we're on the topic, my sadness about the GCC's runtime library exception was it all was done too late. And I actually said this on GPL violations org mailing list not too long ago that really the delay should not have happened and it should have gotten out quicker because GCC really needed it and it gave LLVM room.
I feel bad for my contribution to that delay in a way because...
I mean, Fontana leaving Fontana going to Red Hat was probably one of the worst parts of it. And
let's blame Fontana.
Yeah, well, and the fact that for a long time there, before I dragged you into it, nobody cared. I mean, me and Brett were the only two people, Brett and I were the only two people that cared for a while there. Like 6 months.
It just took a long time.
I dragged you into it.
You dragged me into it.
Because I needed somebody to work on it, and Brett and I were the only ones that cared. I mean, RMS didn't even care for a while there because he was too busy.
It was so hard. It was hard work.
Yeah.
Let's get back to Fontana.
So, I mean, I think the relevance of that to this talk is that creating these license policy documents is very difficult. And so I disagree with Fontana about this idea. He has this argument for concision. That it makes me think of the Noam Chomsky quote about how concision is one of the most dangerous things in policy debates because it makes it so that you can only say the things that are usually said. He talks about it in context of news that if you can't make a point coherently between two commercial breaks, you can never make that point in the modern media because it has to be so short. And so if it's something doesn't espouse what everybody already believes, you need more time.
Yeah, well, that's the problem with software freedom in general. How do we concisely explain its importance?
Yeah, and so, I don't think that you can, and I don't think you can, I don't like this idea that we just compare this to Apache Life. If we had a Copyleft license shorter than the Apache license, somehow all would be good and people would like Copyleft.
Brevity does help. I'm not one of those people. I mean, I kind of think that a more nuanced approach. I know there are problems with the Creative Commons approach of having the explanatory icons and the summaries. But at least there is a high level, very easy to understand, and then the real full license. I know there are problems with that. It oversimplifies it and,
But I've seen this in so many different policy things, GPL enforcement as well, that when you address the issues that people use to attack you, they just find a different issue. So I agree that people attack copyleft on length. I mean, if you look at the comments that the GitHub founder made at OSCON in 2013, it's the same thing. It's talking about how it's a complicated license and so forth. But what he really wants to say is it's restrictive, quote unquote, and the MIT permissive license is not. And so they're going to get to that conclusion one way or another. They're going to use length as an argument when it's long. If Fontana writes a pithy, short copyleft license that basically has all the policy goals, great. It should be used. It should be considered for GPLv4. RMS even said that in an email thread with Fontana about it, that experimenting with making a copyleft license better can't be a bad idea. I think it's how RMS put it, very RMS way of putting it. But even if we get that, I'm not saying the work's a waste of time. I don't think of that at all. I think the work won't solve the main problems that we have with people reacting to copyleft the way that they do. I think that there's
I totally agree. It's a messaging problem. It's not a license
problem. Oh, it's more than a messaging problem. It's that there is an uncoordinated conspiracy. It's not that everybody is conspiring against copyleft. It's that there are lots of interests now that will be happy for copyleft to just go away.
They all have their own reasons. What did you say?
An uncoordinated conspiracy.
I would not describe it in that way. But I agree with you about the underlying issues, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many different companies that don't want copyleft. And now, so I was talking about OpenStack, which Fontana is heavily involved with now, is such a popular, huge project. And it's a unique microcosm to see what's going to happen with regard to the future of copyleft, because it's this huge non-copylefted project that has all this interest and all this code going into it. And is, by most accounts, a very welcoming community, a very organized community, one that people can get involved with quickly and easily. There's even people pushing to end the CLA so that they don't have a CLA barrier, which is probably the biggest barrier they have in the OpenStack community, mainly because of GPL violation defending lawyers like Mark Radcliffe pushing it. But that's probably going to go away. And so hopefully, if they succeed in their efforts to get rid of the CLA and OpenStack. But even if that happens, it's a permissively licensed project, non-copylefted project. Will that succeed? And there's already plenty of proprietary forks of OpenStack.
Mm-hmm.
I think the real challenge to copyleft, I've said this for a long time, is actually the development methodologies have gotten beyond the ability of permissive licenses to say, you don't want to leave trunk behind, is what we used to say, right? And so in the SVN days, CVS SVN days, it was difficult to maintain a branch forever. Software is better designed now. It's easier to maintain a forked version.
Right.
A lot of things are plugin based, and they make it very easy to add little proprietary add-ons here and there that do not necessarily drift from core. And that's what we'll see. And so I don't think, people keep talking about policy questions of GPL, and I'm sort of like, well, when I look at it from two sides, one is the enforcement question, where there's not enough GPL copyleft enforcement anyway, and the enforcement stuff is so difficult. And then on the other side, there's this zeitgeist of we don't need copyleft anymore. I'm not sure what Fontana is trying to do can help us in the short term, or even in the medium term. Maybe super long term, when the tide swings back to copyleft, the fact that Fontana sat down and wrote a better copyleft license, if it turns out to be great, then we can use it at that point. But there's so many other problems we have to solve before we get there, at least for the future of copyleft.
I think it's true, but I do think that the effort is valuable.
Yeah.
And I like the fact that it's there while there's nothing happening, you know, like while there's nothing urgent.
Yeah.
It's funny. I have two minds about it, because I'm one of the, I actually don't love talking about all the theoreticals of licensing. I'm one of the lawyers that's involved in the space who doesn't like to kind of pontificate and get involved in long license threads. I found that very few women do, as it turns out, but, I'm not sure if that's a thing, or it's just the fact that the women that we have in our space are, you know, of different personalities. But so I'm a mix, because I'm not inclined to get involved in the process, if there's not some kind of immediate issue, but at the same time, I think it's really cool that it's there and that people are participating in it, hopefully over time.
Yeah, the thing I like most about Fontana's work is actually the meta stuff. I think that he was incredibly well informed by how badly GPLv3 process went. I really was troubled by, and I've talked about this, I'll link to the threads on the GPL violations mailing list where I've talked about this publicly, that I spent all my time trying to get the public comment process right, and the public comments were more or less ignored. In GPLv3, I was completely distracted by that because I thought, oh, this is great. It's going to engage the public. And I was basically hoodwinked into focusing on that while the real process was kind of this corporate lawyer influenced thing. And to the extent to which, like we were talking about in the first segment about RMS was the author or not. I mean, I think the danger there is that RMS was presented with a lot of options that came from those committees, which were creating false dichotomies and all sorts of stuff that made it difficult, I think, to discern the real issues.
Underneath. I don't know. I mean, RMS is, one thing I've learned from working with RMS is he's really good at like looking through a lot of things and seeing the issues as they are. That's part of why, you know, we talk about the pluses and minuses of RMS's personality, mm-hmm. but that's one of the things that is always held up as sort of like the core of who RMS is and why he's so important.
But the point about that I think Fontana learned from that process was to design the Harvey Birdman rule and this idea that there are certain...
Remind me of what the Harvey Birdman rule is again. I always forget because of the name.
It's a goofy name. It basically is designed to ferret out and discard comments from lawyers who aren't engaged in free software. So it has a, I'll pull up, let's just read through. I think that this, if you want to look at copyleft next, I mean, it's great that Fontana's working on these drafting, but the Harvey Birdman rule it's funny, I searched the net for Harvey Birdman rule, and the second hit is one of my patches to Harvey Birdman rule, rather than the actual Harvey Birdman rule, which is kind of cool. But the center idea behind it is that the people involved in the process have to be basically in a free software way. So for the Harvey Birdman rule has five tenets. The first is contributions as word processing documents are unacceptable and will delete immediately. So this idea of, oh, I'm going to send you a doc file with my comments kind of thing is not accepted. There's no private mailing lists, no Chatham House rule. All public archiving is strongly encouraged. Archives aren't mandatory, but all discussion has to be public, with regard to it. Private telephone calls, private conference calls, private in-person meetings, private email communications shall not be used to discuss substantive development. And then there's this cool exception that he and I designed because Fontana and I would talk privately about his copyleft next product all the time. We do this thing called the Harvey Birdman disclosure, where if you end up in a conversation where you talk privately, you're required to post to the mailing list a summary of that conversation. We call it a Harvey Birdman cure. Where okay, we ended up talking about this. Let's take a couple of notes and post our summary of what we talked about to the mailing list, which every time we talk about copyleft next, which we haven't in a while, we post one of these to the mailing list.
It's interesting because I do think that it's appropriate to have private conversations with people who are working on behalf of companies because there are positions that they might not reveal otherwise. That's not to say that you should, you know, adopt the changes that are motivated by that, but knowing what they are and understanding how that fits in the overall context is not problematic.
So the reason I like HBR,
HBR meaning the Harvey Birdman
rule. Harvey Birdman rule. Yeah. It's basically, it was originally designed as an answer to CHR, which this Chatham House rule, monstrosity that people have adapted.
And why did you choose to make it Harvey Birdman? Like after the comic?
After the cartoon character. Yeah, because he's, quite frankly, because he's an incompetent lawyer. And basically the idea was, let's make sure no incompetent lawyers. He's an incompetent corrupt lawyer. And basically we want to keep incompetent corrupt lawyers out of this process.
Okay.
I'm
really glad. Thank you for this. Cause I've sort of had an idea. I knew sort of what you were talking about, but
I posted a long email at one point about why Harvey Birdman was the right analogy to the mailing list. I'll link to that in the show notes. But I think that this idea of we will do all this discussion public, and if we end up having private conversations, we'll post summaries thereof. I think when you look at GPLv3, and so this weirdness of so to look at the HP objections to GPLv3. So everybody knew HP was anti-GPLv3. Their public statements were against it because of the lockdown provisions. The real reason they were against it was because of the patent provisions. And
everybody knew that, but the HP wasn't on record saying that. So in fact, I think it fed into the anti-lockdown view of the Linux community, right? Because they're saying, well, HP doesn't like the lockdown. HP doesn't care. I'm pretty sure now, of having talked to many people in policy levels at HP, that they don't care about lockdown. They don't want to HP doesn't actually want to produce any lockdown devices. They're not Sony. They're not Panasonic. They're not these TV companies that have close relationship with the MPAA. They're not really interested in doing consumer electronic lockdown devices, but they do worry a lot about their printer patents, and they don't want to inadvertently license the printer patents.
And you think that the Harvey Birdman rule would have prevented this? I'm not.
Because HP would have, if HP wanted to be involved in the GPLv3 or the copyleft next drafting process, they would have to be on record about why they were objecting. And if they were willing to say to people, like, because people were privately saying, oh, it's the patent provisions, but they weren't saying it publicly. I think that's something that would be helped by that. Cause if people want to opine about what they're against the license for, I mean, I give the Linux developers credit. At least they were on public and they wrote a public statement about why they were opposed to the lockdown provisions in GPLv3, right? So at least that big group of Linux developers who did that, they said so publicly.
Oh, I agree with you that there's merit in talking about these things publicly, but I'm just not sure. I'm unconvinced that in every case that not allowing anyone to,
I think that conversation you and I had with Apple should have been public, because it would expose about GCC runtime library exception as a great example, where Apple basically blew up their ability to be okay with the GCC runtime library exception through bizarre objections.
I'm not sure. Okay, I'm really I'm a little uncomfortable right now, listeners.
Fine. Don't say that. Okay. Don't comment on it. I'll comment on it as an FSF director, and that's it.
Okay, good.
So
good, you don't good, have to comment. Okay, I'm not going
but
to.
There's
comment.
And I've said publicly about Apple's objections. I've talked about publicly before, and I've coordinated with FSF on
great.
This.
Oh, great.
So it's all
good.
Fine.
Oh,
do
fantastic.
Not worry about that.
Fantastic.
Yeah, FSF's no friend of Apple. They're happy to criticize Apple any which way to Sunday, because they deserve it. But the thing is that I wish I had that on record. I wish I had, instead of me having to retell the story of what Apple lawyers said that made no sense in their objections to CC. I wish we had them on record making no sense.
Well, they would have potentially participated less or not at all.
They'd barely participate anyway. But the point is that how much worse off are we at that point? And we sort of force them to either make a public comment or
it's
say nothing.
It's sort of tough to quantify, but I guess we'll find out over time.
Things are adopted. The other rules, I read the first three HBR requirements.
Yeah.
The fourth one is no top posting, which I like. But that's more of a time.
I think that's
sort of
kind of jerky.
The thing is, lawyers have the most tendency to top post.
It's because it sort of excludes newcomers. That's an excluding newcomer provision. Because the standard for replying to email for most people who are not coming from an old school developer community is to top reply.
But we didn't, so famously on the mailing list, Josh Gay top replied, and we pointed him to Harvey Birdman rule, and he didn't do it anymore, right?
I mean, someone who's already involved, someone who's not going to be going away. You say that to someone who's new, they're just...
It depends on how you say it, right?
It does depend on how you say it, but it's kind of jerky to me. Okay, go on.
I think you've suggested that probably where it says therefore shall be ignored, we should probably change to say something like, will be requested to be rephrased or something like that, or to be posted or something.
Okay.
Yeah, I think probably ignored is a little
it's
strict.
It's pretty
there.
Harsh.
That's ignored is harsh. The ignored part in there is harsh. I'll link to this Harvey Birdman rule in the show notes, by the way. And then there's the Harvey Birdman modification copyleft, which is patches the Harvey Birdman rule are welcome, but they have to be Harvey Birdman compliant to be accepted. So. You can't privately discuss Harvey Birdman.
Well, we've publicly discussed it now. So.
And this is acceptable. Actually, Fontana and I had a long debate about audio recordings because they're so difficult to index and whether it was acceptable. And we determined Harvey Birdman rule is the thing I've been most involved with in copyleft next, because I was really this is the part that I think was so interesting, and mainly because mainly as an anti-CHR, I've been very disturbed. I'll link to this in the show notes. There was recently this blog post about a bunch of things that happened at the ELN conference regarding free hardware. And a bunch of lawyers sat down in the CHR covered room and had a discussion about they were going to decide what a free hardware license should be without, as far as I can tell, any free hardware practitioners being involved at all. And this sense that that's how we're going to make policy to me is very disturbing. And while I'm not against Chatham House rule, it was designed for conversations where people can get killed if they were quoted publicly on their positions, like things like the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and places where there's serious violence at stake as part of the process. There is not violence at stake.
We definitely overuse Chatham House rules.
I don't think it should be used at all. I don't think there's any justification for it in our community. I
probably agree with you on that.
Yeah, it doesn't.
I think other kinds of like agreements about confidentiality under certain circumstances are probably better.
Yeah, I mean, I've been in rooms where people want to say something and they ask if that statement can be kept confidential. And I've agreed. You know, it's like one statement. If you do it as a one-off and say, I'm actually going to say something here, I really need to be confidential. I mean, granted, that wouldn't be HBR compliant. And we would have to say if it were a Harvard Birdman covered thing, we'd have to say it's an issue. But generally speaking, at a no HBR, no CHR governed meeting, we could do it and it would be fine. You can just have occasional confidentiality when it's absolutely necessary. But yeah, so I think that's the HBR is really an answer to this obsession with CHR in policymaking communities, which is why it's mentioned.
Plus entertainingly named.
Yeah, I mean, that was sort of the goal was to make it funny. And I'll link to my post in the show notes about why I like the HBR name. So Copyleft Next I noticed Fontana, I get the emails on Gatorius when he makes patches, so I saw him putting some patches in as recently as a couple weeks ago.
Oh, okay, cool.
So it's still under active development. And I think Fontana and I it's funny because when I made my original notes for this, we had so many to say, oh, look, here's a patch from just back in February where he added, he put back in the Afero clause thing into it. So he's in agreement with me on a lot of the policy points I was objecting. I think we're still not together on the lockdown part. I think he doesn't want the lockdown restrictions in Copyleft Next. I think they're necessary, but actually I think we can get a lot of that through a better. The thing I'm most interested in and the thing I've actually submitted patches on is the definition of corresponding source in Copyleft Next, because that's my biggest. Concerns that's well defined, because we have so many people manipulating under GPL, trying to underread what GPL says with regard to corresponding source or CCS, complete corresponding source under V2. So that's the story.
Oh, it's Stallman is quoted at the top saying, yes. Exploring ideas for a modified copyleft license can't hurt. If that's not a ringing endorsement, I don't know what is.
Yeah, that's pretty ringing endorsement as RMS gets. Yeah, he shouldn't have organized the repository this way. Oh, he's working on a permissive next too, apparently. I see in the repository. So I guess he wants to replace the Apache license.
So too. Interesting.
So folks should look at his project and contribute. I mean, I think that the best thing Copyleft Next is doing is it's engaging because it's designed like a free. I mean, his main goal, I think, in this was to design license drafting like a free software project, because the biggest problem he and I agree on that was wrong with GPL was there weren't enough developers involved. I mean, developers were basically barely listened to in the GPL V3 process. Corporate lawyers were listened to. And the goal here is this is a license for developers. Developers should be the ones who design the license. I mean, GPL was designed by a developer. The initial GPLs were designed, I mean, the design and of it at least were RMS as a developer designed the license. So I think developers should design free software licenses.
Yeah, I mean,
as much as I criticize the Apache Software Foundation, it's a license designed by developers, right? Roy Fielding is a developer, not a lawyer, and he designed most of the Apache 2. So I don't necessarily agree with the Apache Software Foundation about much, but I like that their license is designed by developers, not lawyers.
Yeah, lawyers are sort of the. You know, lawyers should serve their clients. So, you know, it's sort of.
But they don't want to. That's the thing that drives me nuts, is they want to be important policymakers rather than actually helping their clients. They want to control. Right? I mean, that's the Mark Ratcliffe problem in OpenStack right now with the CLA.
I mean, the FSF ran the GPLv3 process, so.
Well, and they made mistakes. And I think that the FSF would admit that. It was the first time they tried to do something like that. And anytime you try something the first time, you're going to screw it up. The problem was the stakes were too high for a first time. And I wish I hadn't talked RMS out of releasing 2.2. That's the biggest professional regrets of my life. RMS wanted to put 2.2 out in 2003 with the Afero clause as part of the license and everything.
Wow. It's hard to predict how that would have gone.
I don't know, but it would have been better than what we got.
You might, in an alternative universe, you might be saying that very same.
I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, we'll wrap that up, and this was and we should apologize, Fontana, for taking so long to put this talk up.
Thanks for listening. Reason Freedom is produced by Dan Lynch of Pod Factory and can be found at podfactory.org. Thanks to Mike Tarantino for our theme music. This episode of Reason Freedom is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 United States license. You can follow Reason Freedom, Bradley, and Karen on Identica, and also read Bradley's and Karen's blogs. Links can be found on the Reason Freedom website, faif.us. That's FAIF.us.
Everybody went to bed early so that they could hear your talk.
Yes. Just the